Hey guys, welcome back to the Spates Waterlad podcast. It is the final Dance in France review. Jeez, lads, I felt all sorts of emotions after today's game. I guess that's the beauty of the sport. We can be so invested into it, but man, I've been just thinking about all sorts of situations that came out of that game and sort of reliving it all. But obviously South Africa, what a side they are. They'll be absolutely pumped after there. I love hearing Kelisi speak after the game. They've done it incredibly tough. 3 1-point victories in the playoff games. That's an incredible stat. And the first team to ever win 4 Rugby World Cups. That's also such an unbelievable stat as well. Lots to dissect in this one. Couple of games there as well. Of course, we're joined by the last time by Surly from Surly Talk Sport and the legend Jacob the Snakeb Atkins. Jacob, I'll start with you as a neutral and the only one to pick the winner. What'd you make of the game, mate?
Yeah, well, we're kind of digesting it in real time here, aren't we, lads? We normally obviously have a couple of days to go over the games, have a think, come up with some analysis, and we're kind of just reacting to what we've just seen recording the day of the game. I guess reacting as a neutral, it wasn't the kind of game we wanted. I think that was obviously dictated by the conditions. In terms of the game, it was really scrappy, really high error count. And it basically became a game of managing in those errors as opposed to, yeah, you know, trying to make huge plays happen. We obviously saw a few. One of them got chalked off. I'm sure you'll go over that in detail, you lads. But I mentioned it on the preview last week. I just think the South Africa team is set up to win these ugly games. They're the best in the world at it. They have been for a long time. And they have that sort of like emotional maturity and resilience that Rassie's built in that group that things don't really seem to faze them. I thought, you know, the moment we saw it was raining quite heavily in Paris before kickoff, we were concerned it might be a rough day for the All Blacks. And they struggled in a few areas that we thought they might. They struggled under the high ball. In the backfield, South Africa basically put England's game plan from last week onto them. You know, it's similar style to how they ended up beating France. I just think as well, like this South Africa team, they're so battle-hardened. They've had so many of these games, like you alluded to just there in your build-up, Jim, like they had a close game against England. They had a very, very similar game to this against France, I would say. Conditions didn't dictate as much, but the style that they played the game in and the way the game played out was very similar to their quarterfinal against France. They obviously had that tough game in the group stage against Ireland and Scotland. They came out of a really, really tough group. And I just think that maybe came through the way the game panned out.
Yeah.
It's a shame that things like the conditions have such a big impact on a final. You want to see the two teams both offering their best, and I just felt New Zealand were kind of playing with, well, one hand tied behind their back and then the red card, two hands tied behind their back at times. And they did a great job to push it as close as they did, and if they'd won it, I think it would have been one of the great World Cup upsets to win in those circumstances. But just one step too far, I think. Too many obstacles to overcome in that last game.
Yeah, mate, it would have been such an incredible victory if they could have won. And like so many things, they were so close, such small margins in these big games, like we spoke about throughout the whole preview show, that these games often come down to one or two moments, and you can look back on so many of them and think what if, or how could they. But obviously you mentioned South Africa and their ability to their emotional maturity and their ability to win these such close games consistently, like 3 in a row 1-point victories. I don't think that will ever happen again at a Rugby World Cup. Like just the grit and the passion they show for their country, like you say, like they always shout out, like for their country, that they do love it. But geez, it was heartbreak. So obviously we'll get to you, Surly. You're the emotion of New Zealand. You've been riding this journey all day. How are you feeling, mate?
Mate, it was emotional, wasn't it? Like, right from the anthems, you could tell that this game was special. Just those scenes of, like, Kelisi in the tunnel singing village songs. Like, it's just like, I had goosebumps, man. And then the players walk out, the anthems. Like, I've never seen so much passion from both sides. And then the haka. Of course, the French managed to sneak a national anthem in between as well. So full credit to them. You know, they've been in form all tournament and they really made it count on the biggest stage. But yeah, what a roller coaster of a game. Like, obviously, Sam Kane, you're heartbroken for him. There were moments there where you just, like you said, little bounces of the ball. Ardy running onto that chip kick from Geordie. Yeah. Like, will you ever get closer to scoring a try? There were moments there. But I guess the overall disappointment and frustration, and I guess we'll talk about it, but it was just not the game I think that we deserved and that it was built up to be. You've got these two proud rugby nations both chasing four all week. There were throwbacks to 95 and all this type of stuff, and I just think what we were dished up wasn't the spectacle that we'd all hoped we were. It's like, I feel like we lost that game, but I don't know if we lost to a better team, so to say. I just feel like both teams were not really given the opportunity to control the narrative at times. And I feel like that's going to be the main talking point from this. And I hate that we have excuses as to why we lost when it should just be a team winning. And South Africa 100% deserve it. But of course, fans here are just going to blame everything else that went on, and quite rightfully so in many circumstances as well. So that almost makes it even sadder, is like you can't tip your hat and just be like, man, we were completely outplayed there, because there were so many circumstances and other sub-narratives in the game that led to the outcome.
Yeah, I remember saying in the previous show that I was really hoping for a non-controversial victory because then we wouldn't have all this debate, and we could clearly say that one team was clearly the best, but that definitely wasn't the case. There's lots of controversy in it, but you got to hand it to South Africa, the way 100%. They played to those conditions. Like Snake said, they kicked really well. They knew the conditions weren't suited for playing. They backed their defense and they defended bloody well. Like Steph Detoit, 28 tackles, 28 of the biggest collisions I think I've ever seen, and like you said it before, Surly, around Geordie Barrett, ribcage, man, he was just flying into poor Geordie, who we rely a lot on gain line, and a lot of those carries he was getting gain line until he ran into him. But South Africa's defense and just their pressure game, I think they beat us at that. And I love how the All Blacks were still playing, like in the conditions, they still gave the ball air, they're still playing the space, and they found it a couple of times. And obviously the probably one of the greatest tries in Rugby World Cup history with the Richie Moe show and go to only be wiped. That was a huge moment in the game, but that was incredible stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like listening to how we're sort of reviewing the game now, it's making me realise even more, like, it's actually outrageous that the All Blacks got into a one-point game there. You think, like, South Africa played really well. They didn't just kick a lot. Like, they kicked very, very well. They were really, really accurate with their kicks. Their kicking execution was much better than New Zealand's, as well as actually the fact that they looked to kick more. The defence was awesome. And New Zealand played, 65? Well, no, because there was yellow cards as well. So New Zealand played 65 minutes with basically 14 men. Everything stacked against them. To get it to a one-point game is outrageous, in all honesty, like the more and more I think about it.
Yeah. And the other thing that we spoke about earlier in the tournament was South Africa's goal kicking. Obviously, when they played Ireland, Lebok was kicking. He missed a few, cost them the game. Obviously Pollard hasn't missed a kick this Rugby World Cup. Well, that's a stat. New Zealand had a couple of chances, tough kicks, obviously one from the sideline, one from 50 meters on the 15, like not real kickable easy kicks, but just to think if one of those went over, could have been a different story. You never really know. But yeah, the importance of kicking, like you said, Snake, and you're the kicking guru too, so you would have known they were going over as soon as they left the boat. Although, to be fair, a couple of Pollard's early ones were just squeaked in, one off the post, and that was almost right in front too. Another thing with South Africa is obviously their skipper, Khaleesi. Like, what an incredible man that guy is. First guy to ever lift the trophy twice. You hear him speak after a game and you've just got to love the guy. Like, he is incredible how he will address an aftermatch speech. You talk about him singing. Geez, I love watching him sing the national anthem. He gets his head right back, mouth wide open, and just goes for it. And just the passion that he has. And you can see he's got all the boys around him, and they've got a really good leadership group there. So he's got to be one of the greatest captains ever. What do you reckon, Surly?
Yeah, I 100% agree. I can't speak highly enough of him. Like, in world sport, I reckon he's got to be right up there in terms of history of the best leaders, just given like everything that goes on in South Africa. We all know that it's a pretty divided nation at times, but whoever you speak to over there speaks so highly of Kolisi. Like, you'd have to think politics if he wanted to post rugby. Like, he's someone that you could imagine that their country would literally vote for. Just hearing the passion, the way he speaks, how inclusive he is of everyone. And yeah, you're heartbroken that we lost, but I think we said it the other week, like, if New Zealand weren't to win it, I wanted South Africa just for Kolisi, like, just because I like him. I don't have an emotional attachment to any of the other players, but I like seeing him succeed, because when you hear guys like Artie, Sam Kane, all that speak about him, he's just so genuine. You can't not like the guy. So I'm happy for him. And don't get me wrong with what I said before, South Africa did deserve it. Like, they executed a game plan beautifully. Those little cross kicks they were putting in perfectly, like, they identified where Umbrella in on D, they found space there, like, they executed a game plan perfectly. I was more meaning more the narrative in that, but I'm stoked for Kolisi to get that one and be the first to four and the first guy to lift it back to back, because I think he's a figure that will remember in world sport a long time post his retirement.
You're spot on. And I remember you actually saying, I think it must have been the very first preview show when we tried to predict our player of the tournament, and you said, oh, how good of a story would it be, Kolisi, remembering that he's coming back from an ACL injury. He shouldn't be at this World Cup. Most people wouldn't even, you know, most people it's 9 months. I'm not sure how he's managed to do that in sort of three or four, but incredible effort to get back out there and to see him lift that trophy. And speak about what it means for South Africa. Obviously, here in New Zealand, we love our rugby and we're very passionate about it, but it's a different ball game over there in South Africa. You only have to watch that Invictus movie, one of the great movies. You would have watched that a few times, Snake, to realise what
my go-to, yeah.
I think it's his white noise while he goes to bed, isn't it? That's his go-to.
Matt Damon with one of the great performances at 6 or 8. But it does mean so much to them, eh?
Yeah,
man, they're built different. I mean, London is absolutely packed with Kiwis and Saffas, especially the bit of London I live in. So the pubs yesterday were absolutely awesome over here, absolutely rammed. Every score, one side of the pub would go nuts and the other side of the pub would go nuts for the other side. You're right, the passion of the South African fans comes from a different place. I think the passion of the New Zealand fans comes from the love of the actual game, the love of, like, code rugby union. But when the South Africans celebrate, it's about South Africa. It's almost like the game is kind of irrelevant. What they're actually celebrating is how much they love South Africa and the country. And you know, the Kiwis are very much like low-key, might have an All Blacks cap on or a black jersey, but it's, whereas they're like flags, hats, fucking horns, all that stuff in the pub. So it's a completely different level of like sort of passion that they have when they watch this team play, isn't it?
Spot on. And I guess the big thing, the big talking point at the moment from everyone is the refereeing performance, which is a shame. And it was always thing we mentioned at the start of the reviews at the start of the tournament that we're hoping it wasn't going to be and the refs could stay out of the limelight. But obviously they hit the limelight pretty hard in this one. But it's just so hard in these tight games. The way the game is, the way the rules are in the game, it just makes it incredibly hard for a referee to do a job without getting involved. And I guess the biggest thing for me, it's been my pet hate for a while, is the involvement of the team, TMO. And I can live with decisions not getting right. Like, some of those decisions, 50-50 or maybe 75-25, Wayne Barnes might have got wrong. But in the heat of the moment, the speed of the play, it's very hard to get all those right. And you can live with those. Things I hate is missing magic moments. And like that Richie Mwanga set up try for Aaron Smith, that can't be pulled back. I think we lose a massive part of the game if we're going to start bringing those back. For me, my suggestion to World Rugby will be that the referee only sends it up to the TMO if he wants to check a try has been scored or if he wants to check foul play. Everything else, if you get away with something, you get away with something. And we're going to, as fans, we're just going to have to accept there's going to be some wrong decisions. But for me, it's so much better than a TMO checking everything and losing so much of the momentum of the game. And like new people watching that game, you'd be thinking, what the heck has he gone back there for? Like that South African knocked his hand at the ruck. So how have they lost the try? Like it's just, like it seems crazy. Like award the tries, make it flowing. I remember like, and that's not just a bias thing either, because I remember even that South Africa All Blacks game before the World Cup where Moody, the centre, scored that incredible try at Twickenham, beat a few defenders, and then they go all the way back to check a minor offside. And like at the time, I remember saying we should never call back those tries. They've got to be awarded. If the referee suspects something, then he can send it up. But Barnes didn't send up Sam Kane's collision. He didn't send up Khaleesi's collision. That's all come back. He didn't send up any of those tries. It was, it's a TMO double-checking everything and just ruining the flow of the game for me. What's your thoughts there, Surly?
Yeah, I agree. A lot of people have come hard for Wayne Barnes. And look, we were on here last week saying he's the best man to do the job. And look, in hindsight, I still think he might well have been. It's so hard for him, obviously.
Who else would you have gone, hey?
He's got people in his ear non-stop telling him stuff, whether it's players, whether it's the TMO, who was in his ear a lot. And by the end of the game, you could tell Wayne had enough. Like, he just started disregarding it, and I wish he kind of did a bit earlier, but you can't blame him. But like you said, you can live with human error. Like that penalty where he said to Ardy after he watched the replay, "Sorry, mate, I got that wrong." It results in 3 points, and many people now are saying that cost us the game, but I feel way better about that decision than some of the other ones that got sent up from upstairs, because we had opportunities to get those penalties back. What you can't get back is players going to the bin or tries disallowed and things like that. Like, the saddest thing for me around this TMO stuff is when you see a try get scored now and you react with emotion, you're so pumped up, all your group chats, everything go off, man, what a play from Richie Moe, and then it just gets called back. It's like you can't celebrate these moments now until the ball is on the tee, and by then it's more a feeling of relief that you've scored. You lose that passion with all your mates that you're at a game, you're like, wow, what a moment, and then it's brought back and you're crushed. So when Bodie scored, I was sitting there just being like, not until it gets awarded. Yeah, I was just like, no, they're going to bring this back. And that's not what the game's all about. Like, imagine, like you said, if you're sitting there with your kids or whatever and you're trying to get them into the game, and how do you explain these decisions, let alone they get it? And they're fizzed up. They want to see tries, and then they get disallowed. It's just, the TMO, I think they can only act on something if it happens in that phase. So as soon as there's a breakdown, they can't then come back to an error that was prior to that. So it has to be in the phase leading to a try. I think that's what it should be. Rugby league does something very similar. I also think it would be great if we just had the TMO, like you said, just for tries, but then each team gets a captain's challenge. So if a player's not happy with a shot, they think that they've been taken high, no arms, shoulder to the head, they can go to their captain and be like, mate, I just got smoked there. Can you use the captain's challenge? Let's review that. And then if they get it wrong, then they live by that. I think that might actually help as well, because at the moment, they're intervening for knock-ons and things like that from 3 phases ago, and it's just not good for the game. Like, you start to zone out a bit.
Yeah, you're right. Like, my kids were watching the game with me, and they're still trying to work out how Aaron Smith's tries didn't count on the scoreboard. Like,
it's a try. Like, that should be a legit rule. If there's a goosey into a dummy, you can't overrule that, because that is just poetry.
Yeah, and I guess one thing we didn't sort of preview was obviously the refereeing group, all English, snakey. So they've obviously been over in the English Premiership for the last 10 years refereeing the English Premiership, which... for Kiwi fans who don't watch the English Premiership, it is refereed a lot more intensely than Super Rugby. The TMO's in a lot more. I feel like head collisions are refereed a lot more harshly than they are in Super Rugby. But hearing Foster talk after the game, he knew that. They had these guys in the Irish series, so that they're aware of it. But I think a lot of the public weren't aware of it, hence why everyone's pretty shocked. But what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, obviously, Jimmy, you played in both competitions, so you're probably in a good place to feel the differences. I've never played in the Southern Hemisphere, but they definitely go with a much finer comb through everything, and it's the norm to see anything flagged up. You know, the amount of times we'll be watching a game in a pub and you'll just hear people in the background going, check, 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 which is what the TMO says when he's seen something that he wants to speak to the referee about, because it's such an accepted part of the game in the Premiership. You'll just be watching it and you'll hear check, check, and you just think, right, okay, whatever happens for the next four phases might not matter because they're going to go back to something six or seven phases ago. And I really empathise with what you said at the start, Jimmy, because there has to be some kind of guidelines on where it ends, because where do you draw the line? Like, do we go like, oh, fuck, actually, South Africa knocked the ball in the third minute. Lads, you got to get back out on the field. Like, we got to go start again. Like, we're starting the game from minute three again. Like, where do you draw the line on picking up mistakes? And you also then put yourself in that situation where you're saying, okay, we picked up that knock-on, we have to go back for that. Well, if that's the case, then you have to get every knock-on in the game. And you have to, like I said, you have to go back and we have to replay from every single knock-on in the game. Whereas if you treat it like what Jimmy's been saying the whole time we've been recording this podcast, if you accept that there's 30 errors throughout a game that can go against either side and TMO can only intervene for set parameters within certain situations. Yeah, for example, in the Premier League, VAR only comes in for penalty reviews and for goal reviews. That's it. And even then, you know, it's a system where it's not great. Fans don't really like it for the exact reason that Surly just said, because you score a goal and straight away everyone's like, have they checked it? Have they checked it? Have they checked it? So that's by no means perfect either. But I definitely think there needs to be harder or harsher guidelines on where they can intervene in the play and how retrospective the decision can be, because you're opening yourself up to so much criticism if you're saying we're reviewing everything, because then you could just, you know, All Blacks fans could just sit there all game and just find knock-ons and be like, okay, well, the game only started in minute five.
Yeah. Oh, it's the last thing. You just lose the flow, eh? We need to get the flow back into the game. And to me, the best way to do that is to take out as much of the TMO as possible, go back, even if it was old school, like one referee in the middle just doing everything. I don't know. But, that's my thoughts anyway. I guess the other thing around the, I guess, the abuse of the referee is, I guess, the importance of commentators and people having their say, especially the people in the know, sharing their thoughts. And if you're going to abuse a referee or criticise the game, well, then that's what these people are watching, and they're going to share that in the masses on their social media. So I just think that was something that really stood out to me during halftime and after the game around some of the I guess, negative media around it. What's your thoughts there, Surly?
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? Because we, as people that watch a lot of rugby, can easily make up our minds. But when you have, like, family members, relatives and stuff who don't watch a lot of footy and they just tune in for these big games, they certainly, talking to them after, they're just repeating exactly what they've heard, right? Yeah. And, like, that's natural for something that you don't know a lot about. People do it all the time in everyday life. You see it on social media 24/7, but yeah, it has a massive play in the narrative that's then set post the game. So I'm all for seeing, like, emotion and things like that, particularly in great moments, like that try Bodie scored at the World Cup, like the go Bowden, like that's iconic commentary. I'm all for that. But when it's coming in and piling in on someone, I'm not all for that as well, because you then start a dog pile on. So I see both sides where, like, you want people to be authentic and say what they would say normally. But yeah, you do have to remember that you're in a position of power and influence there. So you just got to pick your words wisely.
Well, that's something you do very well, both of you. So selling the game very this podcast. So everyone who's doing it. But I guess overall from that game, I'm super proud of that All Blacks effort to go as close as they did with 14 men for as long as they did. And I guess their whole tournament coming back from the loss against France, a tough start, and then getting all the way to the final. Very proud of of our men in black. So, but we'll get to the next game. We won't be as detailed on this one, but England and Argentina. Watching it, couldn't help but think this was clearly not the third and fourth best team at the Rugby World Cup. There's some fairly average rugby. It sort of felt like seventh versus eighth sort of setup. But England got the job done. Another very close victory. What do you make of it, Snake?
Yeah, it was a game that happened. I think the best way to sum it up is we were talking on our group chat. And when Argentina had a goal to level it, we were all just saying, like, oh, please miss this so it doesn't go to extra time. Please, we can't watch, you know, an extended period of this, 30 more minutes of this. No, I think it was two teams that were physically dust, really, from the World Cup. Probably emotionally dust, like we mentioned, after a tough semi-final losses for both in different ways. Obviously, England, tough semi-final loss. The way they lost, Argentina, tough to get pumped for 80 minutes. But also two teams who, for me, are probably, am I going to be this harsh, probably the worst coached, least tactically advanced teams in the comp, would we say, of the bigger sides who are in the mix in the knockout stages. So there wasn't a lot to really get your teeth stuck into, was it? It was basically a bit of a scramble fest, pretty average attack on both sides, pretty average defense on both sides. The collisions were good. There was some good set piece stuff, but nothing that I really want to talk about in great detail. I mean, the thing for me, as I obviously said in the preview show before, the result didn't matter to me. I didn't care if England finished third or fourth in this World Cup. Like I said, like Jimmy just said, for me, they're probably still in that seventh, eighth slot in the world rankings, and that's a better reflection of where we're at. I just wanted to see a performance that showed me something that we could get behind for our next campaign, you know, something that for the Six Nations or Autumn Series or whatever it is that we go into next. I don't know the international calendar. But something that we could be like, okay, that's base camp now. The team can grow from there. And we just didn't see that at all, did we? The attack was non-existent. There's no creativity. There's no room for individual. It's so rigid. There's no room for individual players to move and flow without within the shape that they have. There's no opportunity for guys to really work off the ball. Like, we've spoken about how much we enjoy seeing that. You spoke about seeing it live at the All Blacks game, Surly, watching guys manipulate the space to work, manipulate the shape, sorry, to work for them, working off the ball, transitioning between different patterns. And we just don't see any of that from England at all. It's very, very rigid. It's very, very structured, but it's not even executed well. You're going to be rigid and structured, like, you have to be on it with your execution. And it has to be like, detail has to be unbelievable. And they're just not there as a group at the moment. And I think I've made it very clear that I don't necessarily think the program is being run by the right people at the moment. I didn't think that when they first came in. I thought the selection was a strange one to replace Eddie Jones. With Borthwick, it felt to me like a trend pick, because he'd won the Premiership with Leicester the season before and had turned them around. Like, you know, for you guys that don't watch the Premiership much, Leicester, obviously a big historic club. They were having a really poor patch. They nearly got relegated one year. He came in three seasons later, they won the Premiership. Really great turnaround arc for the club. But that was very much a guy coming in and rebuilding a club. It wasn't necessarily a guy being the most technically and tactically advanced coach. And I think that is what you need at international level. It's not the same as a club system. I mean, I don't have any coaching experience. Jim, you might be able to speak better on this, but I think international rugby coaching is a very, very different prospect to club rugby coaching, where you're building a team and a squad for a competition week in, week out. And I just don't think they've got the right guys in the right seat. And I believe that England have the players and the player pool, so the group of players outside the squad, to be competitive. I do still think we've got one of the best talented groups of players in the world. But I just think it starts from the top, and I don't see this team progressing unless they make changes at the top. For me, I'd love to be proved wrong, and I'd love them to go on a transition through the next 4 years and become dominant and world-beating, but I don't see where that comes from.
Mate, it's hard to believe you're talking about the third best team in the world right now. They've just won the bronze medal at the Rugby World Cup, and
we'll
absolutely
know
slating them. But it's true. Like, I found that game hard to watch because I felt like England had Argentina on the ropes, but they just had zero killer instinct. They just could not, for some reason, stick the knife in. They kept going for the 3 points when I felt like they were clearly all on top of them. Even in phase shape, they'd have advantage and they'd grubber it into touch instead of playing a shape down the edge where they could maybe get their backs involved. They went, because Argentina's, I spoke about Argentina's edge there. I felt like it's not strong, and they went there a couple of times. They scored when Earl went through, but they didn't go there much more, and it was the biggest frustration for me. I obviously had Henry Undell on my fantasy team as captain, so I was watching this game hoping they were going to get the ball to the edge. Had two touches, kicked them both, and absolute nightmare for my fantasy team. Cost me the tournament, but I guess it's my fault for captaining an English winger, isn't it? What do you make of it, Surly?
Yeah, pretty much what Snakey said when he mentioned the word manipulation before. That's all I had written down for this game, is when I sit down and watch a game between two mutual teams, I want to see an attacking side manipulate defences and just expose weaknesses. And, you know, you want to see that battle between 80 minutes of teams trying to work each other out. But it just wasn't that at all, was it, really? Like, it was just kind of bash and crash, two like solid, passionate forward packs going at it. But man, there's so much more in both of these nations. We've seen it from them before. Like, Argentina came here last year and beat New Zealand playing a great brand of football. England have done it so many times as well, where, like, yes, they've always had a great kicking game and they've always been quite criticized down here for the way they play, but they've had individuals that they've allowed express themselves. When you think of, like, the great English players throughout the years, there's some amazing outside backs, and I still believe they have the talent to do that. But like Snakey said, they're just kind of coached military styles at the moment, and you hate to say it because it's harsh, but I think they kind of want to be on that Springboks type of level, but they're like a poor man's version of it at the moment because they can't execute that style of play as well. And the Springboks also have a bit of razz in them, which England could do, but they just fail to unleash it. So, yeah, I'm a bit worried about them under Borthwick just because of his messaging post-game and stuff. He's talking like they've now found their way to play, especially after losing to South Africa. Like, he was stoked with that, and he was like, this is the blueprint for the next 4 years. No one expected us to be here. We almost bet them. Like, this is how we're going to play. And I don't know if that's the way to do it, to double down on that style of code, because, yeah, you're not going to beat the best teams in the world doing that consistently, I don't feel like. You're just hoping to drag them into a shit fight and come away with it, and you're not going to be able to do that for a whole World Cup.
Mm-hmm. Mate, you'll both make very, very valid points, but I guess from a finals point of view, the fact is that this Rugby World Cup still gave us playoff games where 7 of the 8 games came down to the very last play. So that's a massive plus for where World Rugby is at. I know a lot of people have been quite negative about the tournament now post that final, but the fact is that 7 of those 8 games came to the very last play. So that's an incredible stat. I don't think that will probably happen again. But just goes to show, like, if we had these quarterfinals again starting now, like this week, same games, I guarantee we'd have different teams in the third and fourth and different teams in the final. Like, the teams are just that close, and the things that swing either way, the games were just such fine margins. Anything on that, Surly?
No, I just think, like, when you talk 2023 World Cup, like you mentioned, I think everyone will just remember those quarterfinals, two of them especially, as like iconic games in rugby. And it's, again, like, it's almost a shame that it won't be remembered for the final. It will be remembered for those two quarters, and some great pool games as well. Like, overall, as a competition, I think it's been really good. There's obviously got its flaws, but, you know, Portugal, Fiji, you had those story teams that, like, people really got behind. Then you had France beating New Zealand first up, and then the results all kind of playing out how they have, Ireland, South Africa. So we were treated to some good games throughout this competition. It's just a shame that it finished kind of on that note. But those quarterfinals, man, like, that, they'll be remembered forever.
Yeah, you're right. It's a shame one of those quarterfinals wasn't the final, really. It would have been such a cool way to finish what has been an awesome Rugby World Cup. So a couple of things that come out from last week, obviously, the nominees for Player of the Year. I'm pretty keen to get your guys' prediction there. So obviously, I think that's tonight even. So mate, this is going to be fresh. Player of the Year nominees: DuPont, Ardy, Eben Etzebeth, and Bundy Arkey. Who are you going, Snake?
I think the obvious one would be DuPont. I think it's fairly easy what they've tried. It's very clear, sorry, what they've tried to do there. They've tried to identify one player from each of the big four international teams at this World Cup. I think Bundy Arkey is maybe a bit of a reach. I don't know if you boys agree with me. I think they probably felt we have to get one Ireland player in here because Ireland have been the sort of outstanding team for the last 2 years. But as I've said so often on this podcast, like, Ireland are an outstanding team because they're so well connected, organised and coached. They don't necessarily have the world-beating players that go one for one up against other teams. You know, I actually said when it was one of the games, maybe it was the Ireland-New Zealand game, I don't know how many Ireland players I would pick in a combined 15, but together they're better than the sum of their parts. Yeah. So I'm not sold 100% on the nominations list, but I think the obvious one is DuPont. I can't imagine you guys are going to disagree with that too much. I mean, Ardy's had a fantastic World Cup, but I think DuPont's the best rugby player I've ever seen play the game, let alone this year.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, all the comments I'm reading is that it's all about Ardy. Maybe it's because I'm New Zealand heavy, but I'm with you. I think it's so hard not to give it to DuPont. I know he probably hasn't had the World Cup that he could have. He still played really well every time he played, but he obviously was out for a few weeks with the fracture, didn't get to play in semis and finals. So obviously people, you won't get to, I guess, add up those scores as well. But Ardy's had a massive year. He's so consistent. He's a freak. I think it's out of those two personally. Obviously South Africa winning it, do they lean toward Eben Etzebeth there because of the fact that they won it? Is he the best player? Has he been the best player this year? He hasn't been for me, but yeah, I'm with you. I'd personally go DuPont or very close to Ardy. What about you, Surly?
Yeah, I think I agree. Obviously, I love Ardy, so that kind of puts the blinkers on a little, but I think it would be 60-40 in terms of DuPont. I think, like, Kiwi fans, we see so much of Ardy, and he's like that leader that just, and that player that everyone loves. You'll never hear anyone say a bad word about him. So I think it's only natural for us to be like, oh yeah, Ardy's unreal. But I think when you factor in DuPont's year of work, and just like, if he's not in that French team, it just falls apart in a way. Like, he is the maestro that makes them the best, one of the best teams in the world. And if he's not there, then they kind of drop down to that 6 or 7 range, which might be a little harsh. They do have some good depth and stuff, but I just feel like, yeah, he's a wizard. So yeah, either of them deserve it. It'll be interesting to see which way they go, but yeah, if you said to me right now who's the best player in world rugby, I'd say DuPont.
Yeah, fair enough, and very hard to argue. The other one is the breakthrough. I think this man is clearly, what we spoke about him, how much baby oil he's got him. He still had it on him in the final. Man, this guy is incredible. Man, he can create some stuff. Mark Talia, anyone disagree with that? Hard to make a case, eh, for anyone else in that.
Yeah, it's the obvious pick, isn't it?
Yeah. And coach. I'm interested in the coach, because why is Russi not nominated for Coach of the Year?
Because he's not the South African coach. He's South African director of rugby. So he was the head coach of the last World Cup. He stepped back, they brought in a new head coach, and then they brought Razi back in as like a cultural and vibes director. So he actually isn't the head coach.
Wow, I didn't know that. That is good. I was wondering, I was reading that, like, how's the assistant been nominated? Yeah. He must be an absolute wizard.
Yeah.
Because if you look at you know international teams do their, before every test match, they do the photo. The guy sat in the middle of that, who I don't know his name, is the head coach, yeah.
Jacques Niedenbaugh or something. It's interesting though, because Jacques and Russi picked the team. Like, Russi's very much involved. Every camera shot, it clips to Russi, but Jacques just happens to be in the shot as well. It's hard case, but you could go some interesting ways with this coach run, because
I agree.
Like, does the Fijian coach Raiwalui not deserve it? Man, like the progression in their game as well has been crazy. So it depends how you want to look at things. Obviously, South Africa, they've just won a World Cup, and they had like the All Blacks, they had a pretty interesting year coming in. Like, so their form into the tournament, obviously they smoked us at Twickenham, but their rugby championship form in that wasn't amazing. So it's going to be hard to overlook him, but that Fijian coach could be right up there.
Yeah, and don't forget Farrell either. Like, the year that Ireland had, 17 wins on the trot until that quarterfinal. Snakey's already said it, like, probably not the best player-for-player squad, but best coach side, he believes. So, like, there's a real good case for all of them. And even Fozzie, who's had a hell of a tough year to be able to get that All Blacks into that performance into the final. It makes a shout, but I don't think he'll be winning it. For me, it will be either... probably any of the other three, really, could make a case for all of them. So, interesting. We'll follow that one closely. Lastly, to finish, my fantasy team. Everyone wants to know where I finished up, and this is tough with that last round. But I think everyone had a pretty shocking round. With there wasn't many points available in those last two games. But I ended up dropping two spots, finished in 11th. Disappointing finish, but... I think fantasy rugby's been one of the real successes of this Rugby World Cup. Man, lots of messages, lots of interaction with people around watching the games, getting up early to watch their triple captain play in a minnow game, which just gives you all that extra interest. So rugby definitely need to double down on that when they hit Super Rugby this year. Shout out to Eddie Jones as my dad, who won the Waterlad League.
Hey, Eddie got a win.
Congratulations.
He could be the next coach of the Wallabies by the sounds of it. Get him in.
His son's a squad. He might be off to Japan with his old man. Or is he? And a special thanks to Mint Undies for supplying undies for all the winners of these Instagram competitions that I've had going throughout the year to add a little bit of interest as well. No one got Bodie Barrett at the... 60 something minute mark. It would have been a tough prediction, but maybe we'll get another crossover competition going for another time. But appreciate you two guys for coming on weekly as well, giving in your insights. True lads. Looking forward to seeing where your analysis game goes over the next few years, potentially on the TV, or I know at least the radio for both of you. So
keep
your passport and get over here, Snake.
Yeah, cheers, lads. I'll see you in, 2027, Australia?
Yes, that's it.
Waterland Live on the field, surely.
Yeah, hopefully the podcast has grown massively by then. We can all just be sitting in the
media stands passes,
with our mics, just live commentary and reactions. But we'll see where we get to. Appreciate your time as always, lads.
Legend, it's been bloody good.
Nah, yeah, it's been awesome. I've loved it, boys.